behind the news. Time check. It's 8 p.m. This is Radio Ghana.
Live from the National Studios in Broadcasting House, I am George Asikri with this edition of Behind the News, where we bring you latest updates and detailed analysis of current happenings in Ghana and beyond. Tonight, a 400-seater Airbus arrives in Tamale Airport to convey stranded prospective Hajj pilgrims. We'll tell you the very latest shortly. The NDC's ideological school and the deep-seated cracks within the party. What does the school bring to the NDC? We find out. And some Nigerians demonstrate to demand the resignation of ailing president. Details of all these stories on our show tonight. Our text line is 0266-026-941. Welcome back. It's Behind the News. We are live on Radio Ghana. We're live on all our FM stations across the country to our very first story. Prospective Hajj pilgrims are currently in a queue boarding a 400-capacity Airbus which arrives at the Tamale International Airport some minutes ago. There was an earlier delay raising questions as to the fate of this year's Hajj pilgrims. This was worrying as it came in the wake of earlier speech by the vice president when he inaugurated this year's Hajj, where he assured the nation that the pilgrims will be devoid of hitches. So what is the latest on the ground? Our reporter is Mutala Issa. He joins us from the Tamale International Airport. Mutala, good evening and welcome to the program.
Good evening, George, and good evening to your listeners.
What is currently happening at the airport?
Well, as we speak, the last passenger is boarding the Airbus 330 that touched down at about 6:18 this evening. It has been much awaited for, but finally it is here. Yesterday we were here around this time, but the plane never came. Unfortunately, today, this evening, we are going to have different stories to tell. As we are telling now, the passengers, prospective pilgrims, have boarded the flight as we are speaking.
We understand the Airbus is about 400 capacity. So is it enough to convey all of them?
Yeah, it's a 424 capacity airline. And yesterday, they were supposed to have picked 505. Unfortunately, that could not happen. But today, the airline that came, remember, we are told that there was a hitch with the, yesterday's airline. That is why it couldn't come. So this is a different airline that has come. And it is not up to yesterday's capacity. However, the vice president gave us assurance this evening that all the prospective pilgrims would be flown out of Tamale and nobody will be left behind, even if it has to. If it means getting the flight to come more than the five scheduled flights that were supposed to take place.
So those that are in the airport now, is it possible all of them will go tonight?
Well, everybody is on board now. All the buses are empty. And I am told that even some... everybody is gone now, as you speak. Nobody has been left behind. Those who are supposed to have been leaving today had yesterday's flight taking place are those who have not been picked. However, there is assurance that tomorrow another flight will be here and it will be carrying them away. So... presently at the airport, nobody is being left behind.
Is the vice president in Tamale?
Yeah, the vice president is in Tamale and he's thrilled to join the pilgrims, say goodbye to them before the flight takes off here at the airport. So we are waiting for him. He's supposed to be here within any moment from now to bid them farewell in the flight before they take off.
So how is the airport like in terms of business activities?
Well, it is a bit calm. Yesterday, we came here, there was some kind of excitement, but because of what happened, that calmed down, and people were a bit anxious when we got here this evening. They don't want to just show that excitement. There were doubts that the plane might not come, but finally it is here. However, if you go to the Hajj village, food vendors have taken advantage of the unfortunate incident, the delay, and they make quite some money. People who sell beverages, pure water, and even food in general, they made quite some money, and they are still making money there because people slept at the Hajj village. Mind you, the Hajj village is not anywhere near the Tamale airport. If you know the Tamale Sports Stadium very well, that is not too far from the Ghana Broadcasting Corporation office. That is where the Hajj village is located, and they are making quite brisk business over there.
Until this evening, when the Airbus arrived, there was this kind of uncertainty all over the country because of the delay in arrival. How did the local media report on it in Tamale?
Well, if you watch some media, from newspapers, you would have seen front pages indicating this morning that pilgrims were flown out of Tamale last night. And that we were all caught up in this. I must admit that we were all caught up. Because as at 11, we were told that by 12 midnight, the flight would arrive and airlift pilgrims. Most of us got exhausted and left with the belief that the flight would touch down and then fly off eventually. Well, this morning we woke up to the shock that the pilgrims could not leave. We laughed at each other, and then we learned some lessons in journalism that until you see it happen, you don't report. So these are some of the lessons that journalists here have learned. The truth is that some reported that the pilgrims had been flown out of Tamale.
Right. Mutala, I want to thank you very much for your time on our show. Very grateful.
Thank you, George.
Mutala Issa is our Northern Regional Correspondent speaking to us from the Tamale Airport, where we understand the Airbus is about taking off because the last passenger has entered the Airbus. We have also on the line the Director of Communications of the Hajj Board, Alhaji A.R. Gumda. Good evening, Alhaji, and welcome to Behind the News.
Hi, good evening, my brother.
What explains the initial delay in arrival of the aircraft?
Yeah, indeed, we were made to know that the aircraft was going to touch down at about 4 p.m. After the ceremonial aspect of the flag off of the takeoff of the departure of pilgrims from Tamale. That is, the first segment included the speeches by prominent personalities like the Vice President, His Excellency Dr. Mahmoudou Bawumia, the National Chief Imam, and the Chairman of the Hajj Board. After that, we expected that in the evening, we will go for the Vice President to bid farewell to the departing pilgrims. Unfortunately, it didn't happen, and we had to wait till after midnight. The Interior Minister, Honorable Ambrose Derry, and others were holed up in a meeting discussing with representatives of the airline, one Mr. Ashirifi, as to what was going to happen in the face of the delay. But it turned out that later, when the Vice President visited the stranded pilgrims, as it were, he told them that the delay was as a result of the aircraft which was heading for Tamale from Jeddah turning back as a result of a technical hitch which was discovered. However, the time they said the replacement was going to be sent came and passed, and we had to continue waiting with the associated inconveniences to the pilgrims, prospective pilgrims, and we managers of the Hajj. Well, eventually, the plane did arrive, and as you rightly said, it is about taking to the air for the journey to Medina in Saudi Arabia.
So what's the arrangement like for those who are left?
Those who are left, in fact, information reaching me suggests also that the aircraft is unable to contain the 506 or so prospective pilgrims. as a result of which a certain number would be left behind. However, a strongly worded correspondence requesting the airline dubbed Flynas, registered in Saudi Arabia, is requesting that the next batch be doubled if we can have two aircraft, so that the possible inconveniences related to the inability to airlift all the 506 or so pilgrims would not be encountered. So as I speak to you, we are awaiting the response of the airline to the request put out by Chairman of the High Board, Sheikh Isi Quay.
Alhaji, we have Muslims all over Ghana, and it appears the attention is on Tamale Airport. What happens to Muslims in Accra who want to go to Mecca?
Well, the attention is riveted on the Tamale segment because the exercise is starting with the Tamale pilgrims, where five flights would be sent to Saudi Arabia. It is after the numbers have been exhausted in Tamale that attention will be shifted to Accra, where the remaining flights would be taken to Saudi Arabia. So that is the situation now.
So if you are Muslim in Accra, it means you have to wait for some time.
Oh, yes, yes. If you are bound to take off from Accra, you have to wait until the Tamale exercise is completed. It will be completed in the next 5 days, all things being equal.
So what other arrangement do you have for the safety of our brothers and sisters going?
Oh, well, all has been done to ensure their safety and comfort. In fact, but for this delay in the arrival of the aircraft from Flynas, it would have been positive throughout.
Right. I want to thank you very much for your time and wish you all the best time.
Thank you very much, my brother.
Alhaji A.R. Gomda is the Director of Communications of the Hajj Board. We also have on the line Sheikh Yakub Shaibu Aban. He is an Islamic scholar and the General Secretary of Al Sunnah Wal Jamaa. Good evening and welcome to Behind the News.
Thank you.
And Amasi, wassalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Tell us, pilgrim, and we keep hearing, what's the significance?
Come again?
What's the significance of this trip to Jeddah?
Well, alhamdulillah, rabbil alamin, wa salatu wa salam ala rasulullah wa ba'd. Pilgrimage to Mecca is one of the five pillars of Islam. Islam is built on five major pillars. That is belief in God, you know, prayer, fasting, paying zakah, that is paying tithe, and then the fifth pillar is Hajj. But that one, it requires somebody with a capacity. If you get the money and you have the strength as well, then it becomes, you know, compulsory for you to go to Hajj. Otherwise, you are not compelled. And so it's a requirement which needs to be fulfilled if you have the wherewithal to. And so you go there, you perform all the ritualistic aspects of, the Hajj for you to attain, you know, sort of piety, added piety, and then you expect your sins to be washed away, and then you become just like a newborn baby. And so, you know, we put a lot of premium in the performance of Hajj if you have the wherewithal. But it's compulsory on every Muslim just once. If you get away with that and you can go, you go just once. If you go any other time, it's something else. But Hajj itself is once in a man's lifetime.
So the blessing remains same even if you go 10 times?
No, if you go, I'm saying that the first time you go, the one that you are compelled to go is one.
Okay.
When you go that, the rest, you have the rewards, but it's not as much as, you know, the one which is named Hajj. We have Hajj. Once Hajj is performed, whatever you do is called Umrah. That is supplementary. That is supplementary. So it's not like the obligatory one.
So when they get there, what do they do? What's the procedure like?
The procedure is when you get there, you head straight away to the Kaaba, where we have the Haram, the mosque, which contains the Kaaba. So you go there, you start your performance by circumambulating the Kaaba 7 times, and then we have a walk from one end of two mountains. We call them Safa and Marwa. You walk through them 7 times, and then you pray, at a place we call Makam Ibrahim. And then after that, you wait till, the 8th of the month of Dhul-Hijjah, that's next month. It falls, within either, on the 1st or the 2nd of September, to say. And so when that time comes, you go to Mina. From Mina, you are taken to Arafah. That is on the 9th day of that month. And then after Arafah, you go and throw stones, symbolical, throwing of stones at a place called Muzdalifah. At a place called Jamara. You go and throw the stones there, and then from there, your animal sacrifice is done. And then you continue doing that ritual until the time comes for you to come back. And then you go and perform the last circumambulation of the Kaaba and its attendant walking through Safa and Marwa. And then your Hajj is complete.
That looks quite tedious.
Yeah, quite tedious.
But, so the sacrifice.
If you have the belief and you have the push, you do it, and then at the end of it, you are so pleased with yourself, and you have the feeling that you have obeyed your Lord, and the rewards are there for you to take in the hereafter. So that kind of contentment washes away any kind of tiredness and stress that you put in.
You did mention animal sacrifice. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, that is also symbolic. You remember when Abraham was ordered to sacrifice his son, he was bent on fulfilling that of instructions from the Lord, and so he wanted to do that. And then God Almighty brought an animal from the heavens, to take the place of the son, and so we do that kind of sacrifice to symbolize what our great grandfather Abraham did.
So is it a case that every pilgrim goes there with an animal?
No, the animals are bought there. The animals are bought there and are slaughtered there. You don't need to carry an animal from here to Saudi Arabia.
So if I get once
you pay your money, within it, you have your animal sacrificed.
So where they stay whilst there, is it one place, looking at the 3 places you mentioned?
Yes, when you go to Mecca, you stay in Mecca, and then when, it's time for you to go to Mina, you are camped at, one place, at Mina. And then from Mina too, they go to Arafah.
So Arafah, whether you are in Mina or Arafah,
after praying there and then supplicating, you don't sleep there. You don't enter. You come back to Muzdalifah, and then the following day you go to Jamara to throw the stone.
Oh, okay. So why is it that when they return they are called Al-Hajjis?
Yeah, because it's a pilgrimage. So if you go to the pilgrimage and come back, you are called a pilgrim, and that is the meaning of Hajj.
Oh, okay.
When you say Al-Hajj, it means a pilgrim. Hajjia, it means a female pilgrim. That's all about it.
Oh, okay. Sheikh, I want to thank you very much. But some quick one. You said there are 5 pillars.
Yeah.
And I get the impression that 2 are not necessarily compulsory, especially when you are poor. The tithe and then the pilgrim to Mecca.
Yes, sir. Yes.
So if you are poor, necessarily you may not need to fulfill those 2.
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, if you are poor, you need to benefit from the tithe.
Oh, okay. So you pay it to the poor?
Yes.
Not the imams?
No. It's not meant for the imams. It's meant for the poor.
Oh.
So if an imam is poor, then he qualifies because he's poor, not because he's an imam.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sheikh, we are very grateful for your time on our show tonight.
You're welcome.
Sheikh Yaqub Shaib Aban is an Islamic scholar. He's the General Secretary of the Al-Sunnah Wal Jamaa. It's Behind the News. We are live on Radio Ghana. Keep your messages coming on 0266-026-941 to our next story. The NDC, formed in 1992 as a political party, was an offshoot of the PNDC. The party has an agenda and it has principles, we are told, of probity, accountability, equity, solidarity and social justice. The party drew its membership and supporters from all the existing political traditions. The main attraction was the achievement of the PNDC government and the personality of the leader, Jerry John Rawlings. In 2002, the party held its first Congress at the Accra International Trade Fair Center at Accra after losing political power in 2000. As part of effort to reorganize the party, the Congress adopted several reforms. Key among them was the formal proclamation of social democracy as the party's ideology. It was in furtherance of this that the party has established this Ghana Institute of Social Democracy to instill and imbibe in its members, as well as the youth, the knowledge, understanding, and practical application of the party's core principles to allow for the mainstreaming of the social democratic philosophy in the NDC's policies and programs. We have on the line the acting rector of the Ghana Institute of Social Democracy, and he's also the director of research of the NDC, Dr. William Ahaji. Good evening, Doc, and welcome to Behind the News.
Good evening, and thank you for inviting me.
Doc, how different is the NDC's Ghana Institute of Social Democracy from Kwame Nkrumah's ideological institute?
First of all, in those days, the debate was about conscientization, indoctrination, etc. But it's changed a bit to imparting knowledge and imparting skills as well. What we are offering as an institute is not just the philosophy and the ideology of the party, but other skills that will enable those who will go through the institution to perform and discharge their duties at all levels of the party, the party structure, and also when they are in government, when the party is in government.
So, what is the admission requirement?
Basically, this is intended to, as you rightly said, to transfer knowledge of the philosophy and the ideology of the party to all party members, as many of the party members of the party as are capable of benefiting from it. Would be there. So it doesn't require academic qualification. It requires membership of the party, interest, and availability to go through the different kinds of programs that we have for those who would come to the institute.
And for knowledge, we are all told to acquire. The Bible says it, the Quran says it. So if somebody from the NPP or any other party wants to acquire this knowledge, will you admit the person?
What we said, in fact, what the General Secretary said, if you recall, so that it's for all Ghanaians. Sometimes people would want to understand what the other party's philosophy is. I mean, when you say social democracy, a lot of people still think it is socialism. It isn't. And therefore, why not? If there is vacancy and there is time and there is interest, even if you can't come to the physical location, you can take courses online. I mean, so you learn. So, yes, we invite all people of like minds or anybody who is interested in understanding this whole issue about a social democracy. In any case, even when we are delivering that, we ought to also let people know what liberal democracy means, because then it will give you the opportunity to understand the difference. And NPP is a liberal democratic party. So, yes. But for now, our primary focus is building the knowledge base of our party members. And we will actually open it up, and indeed that was said yesterday, for people within Ghana and others from other parts of Africa as well.
Will your students be certificated?
Well, yes. Ultimately, we are looking at, as we have seen around the world, an institution that awards certificates. And as in China, for instance, they have a university for training people. So it may grow into a university. We will never know. But at least for now, we would offer certificates. And it's even useful, because some of the programs we are offering are for even aspirants into parliament. And so they know parliamentary procedures. They know we'll do constitutional studies. We'll do the history of Ghana. We'll do citizenship and patriotism and all of those other things that will make you, you know, a functioning member of our society and a holistic person. You understand what your roles are and what your responsibilities are as a citizen.
Will students be required to pay some money?
For a certain category of students, yes. Especially foreign students, yes. And then for some, you see, they are not. It's not intended only for the youth. Some are customized courses, and some are courses for instance, those who will be appointed into public office. And it's such a contribution for us to be able to maintain facilities and perhaps offer some help to faculty who will be delivering some of their courses and the lectures. So it's not, we are not charging, you know, commercial fees for even registration purposes, just a token, and that's what we will do to run the institution.
Dr. Haji, does the establishment of the institute has anything to do with the Professor Kwesi Boutwe Committee's report?
The institute actually began last year. If you look at our logo, you will see 2016 there. We started it. We even organized a Saturday institute and delivered. The first lecture was delivered by the former chief of staff, Atu Dazi. And so we've been running for some time. We had to put it on hold because the elections have come. We were even going to go and do what we call the mobile school in the run-up to the election, but we had to put that on hold because of the election. But let me also add, having been a member of the Professor Kwesi Boutwe's committee, that the need for ideological training was strongly recommended by the committee, because we need to understand, at least achieve a common understanding of the ideology of the party to which we belong. We have had situations where people tend to say different things about what the ideology of the party is about. So it was strongly emphasized by the committee report.
So those who will argue that for the NDC, when you are in opposition, you are committed to your core principles. The story is not same when you are in government. What do you tell such?
That's obviously false. That's clearly false. Yeah, as I said, this process started even before last year, 2 or 3 years ago, and we've been working at it. And so that's not to say that because we've gone into opposition, we are beginning to do something different. No. This has been an ongoing process. In any case, opposition allows you to reorganize and do a lot of things that you probably are too busy running the state machinery to do. So why not? You stand back and look at your performance. You have to review what you did. You look at what you didn't do right and what your omissions and your commissions. And then you re-strategize, reposition yourself for the next election. We've won elections for opposition before. So this is not anything about, being pushed to do things because we are in opposition. No, a political party, indeed in representative democratic systems, a political party is an institution, is one of the pillars of democracy, and is an institution, a government in waiting when it's in opposition. And therefore, it has to be preparing itself to assume the stewardship of the country when it is voted into power, so it can implement its policies that derive from its ideological position. So there's nothing wrong with what's happening.
Are you getting external support, for instance, from the Socialist International?
Well, as you know, our general secretary is the first vice president of Socialist International. So we'll leverage the political capital that we have in international institutions, some of those that espouse social democracy. Friedrich Ebert Stiftung is one of those institutions that has helped us over the last, in fact, they even sponsored our Saturday Institute. So, yes, we will raise resources from like-minded institutions, both within and without.
Doc, is the school going to take a form as it grows of an open university system?
Yes, we are going to do virtual learning, delivering some of the courses through a virtual learning approach. But we also have a brick and mortar campus where people, particularly those who want residential facilities, can go and acquire the knowledge. So as we did 2 days ago, yesterday, one of the committees that was inaugurated yesterday was the Estate Committee, which will be looking at issues around the construction of a campus. And so, yes, we would use different means of delivering our programs. One of them, obviously, is the virtual learning. Another one is brick and mortar, I mean, real stationary thing. And then we also have our mobile school, which will mean that we would move faculty around to conduct training on site, at location, in the constituencies, in the regions, and wherever the need arises.
So those who did not follow you yesterday, is it a case that you have some structures in place and where?
For now, we are using the party office, the headquarters, for running our programs. And as I said, in time, we'll move into our facilities. But as you know, the headquarters is central, so we'll be using that for the programs that will be running from close to the end of this month until the campus is ready.
Yes. Okay. Doc, I want to thank you very much for your time on our show tonight. Very grateful, Sam.
You're welcome. Thank you also for giving us the opportunity to talk.
Dr. William Ahaji is the acting rector of the Ghana Institute of Social Democracy and also the director of research of the NDC. It's Behind the News. We are live on Radio Ghana.
It's probing, it's intrusive, yet excited. Your daily news analysis program, Behind the News, is on Radio Ghana at 8 p.m. sharp, Monday to Friday. Join the crew and be part of all the interesting analysis and hard interviews on your exciting Behind the News. It's intrusive yet exciting. Your daily news analysis program, Behind the News, is on Radio Ghana at 8 p.m. sharp, Monday to Friday. Join the crew and be part of all the interesting analysis and hard interviews on your exciting Behind the News.
Welcome back. A section of Nigerians are demonstrating, demanding that the president, General Muhammadu Buhari, resigns or comes home to rule. The demonstrators claim that the president cannot be ruling his country from another country and want him to choose between coming home to rule or abdicate the seat at the presidency. Behind the News examines the implications of the demonstrations for good governance and stability in Nigeria, which remains Africa's most populous country. We have on the line Ben Arthur. He's an international relations and alternative dispute expert. Good evening and welcome to Behind the News.
Let me take this opportunity to say some facts. I'm a labor conflict resolution and peace and security expert.
All right.
So, of course, I have an international relations background. So it doesn't spoil anything, you know. just to put it across.
All right. So, what are the implications of what some people call anti-Buhari demonstrations?
Well, I thank you once again. And let me say good evening to all our cherished listeners. It is a legitimate demand in that the Nigerian Constitution allows freedom of demonstration, association, and assembly, and protest, or what have you. So, if somebody is protesting against an issue that the group deem it as very important on their heart, definitely it's a legitimate, you know, means for them to demonstrate. But as whether when a president is sick, he can no longer occupy his office, that is a very key issue that all of us need to discuss dispassionately. Number one, can we also say that when a civil servant is sick or is taken ill, instead of giving that individual a sick leave, we should rather sack that individual or force that individual to resign? If the answer is no, then definitely, morally and logically, we cannot extend it to presidency and say that it is a very sensitive position. Yes, we could also understand that for some special reasons of being deputized, we have a vice president. So if you are not able to perform, the vice president should be allowed to perform. I go with that argument. But to say that a president who is seeking medical attention or has gone for medical checkup should just resign will not be a very good thing for us as an ECOWAS bloc. And it should not also happen in Ghana. We can understand the sentiment in Nigeria. Having had a sick president who had died, you know, whilst he was in office, we have also had a similar issue in Ghana where people had complained of the late President Melsus, you know, ill health, and he also died. So I could understand from the protesters' point of view that they foresee such eventualities. But whether they can foresee it or they cannot foresee it, it is just against the human rights of the president that basically because he's sick, he should resign. In our constitution in Ghana, if it had happened in Ghana, unless one can prove that the president is incapable of performing his duty, and a panel will be constituted to really come out with a recommendation before we can even take an action, whether it is an impeachment or forcing the president to resign, whatever. But in Nigeria, it is not a good thing at all for people to begin to protest against that. You know, Nigeria is known for some of these protests. If the Caliboy and his group are not careful, they are going to mass up a lot of people who are already agitating for regime change. And the opposition will go behind them. Others will go and sponsor them. And there will be chaos in Nigeria. At the end of the day, if he is resigning or he is resuming, I think that his health is critical. He could be forced to come back. President Buhari could be forced to come back because of the demonstration. But let us ask, if he comes back and he is not well and he is making the wrong decisions for them, would they like it that way? I would have preferred that having the corruption issues in Nigeria, if there are a group of people who can really protest and protest very well, they should begin to chase out those who have, you know, taken Nigeria monies illegally so that they will refund it or they should be put into prison.
And I think that the
teeming masses will get something to do.
Listen to some of the demonstrators. The argument some are giving out is that, look, General Buhari is a tough man, and when he is there, he's got the balls to go after those who are corrupt, but the acting president necessarily does not do that. And so his presence means a lot to them in the fight against corruption.
Yes, I understand. But if you acknowledge that his absence is bringing an attenuating effect in the fight against corruption, then the energies with which you will be demonstrating against the fighter, you have to use it to augment it. And that is the argument I am making. That if the sitting, the vice president is not doing it very well, the question is, if you ask President Buhari to resign, is the vice president who takes over automatically? There's not going to be fresh election. And that is the position of the Nigerian constitution. So that argument does not wash very well, that the president should resign. And when he resigns, it is the vice president that you are complaining about. It's the vice president who is going to take over. And he's going to take over absolutely. So how would you be able to get what you want? That's why I'm calling on them to use their energies to chase out or to demonstrate against those who have been cited for corruption. And that would be a positive strength for the president to even recover, you know, in no good time.
The action of these guys could have serious implications for the economy of Nigeria. Of course, if you are demonstrating, I'm sure people around may not feel comfortable doing business. What should be the ideal response from the security agencies?
The security agencies, despite what we can predict as economic repercussions, social, political undertones, they have to be very circumspect. I know in West Africa and in Africa in general, sometimes incumbent parties try to use state force to clamp down on any opposing. That should not be the alternative, because anything that will force the people or do anything that will be committed against their human rights, it can be a trigger for violence. And sometimes you cannot predict the response from the other side. So the army, the police, and the interior security in Nigeria should be very circumspect about this, that the people have the right to demonstrate. Where I can predict is where opposition parties begin to rally around this issue. And they will begin to amass people, you know, to bash people, sponsor people to begin to demonstrate. This is not to say that if political parties are not sponsoring any group of people to demonstrate, the people don't know what is right. It is within their capacity to do that. But I know that financiers from other side of the political divide will get in there. I am talking from the point of view that Nigeria is more or less the hegemonic power in West Africa. And when there are skirmishes in Nigeria, when there are violence in Nigeria, when there are insecurity in Nigeria, one of the first places that Nigerians run to, you know, is Ghana. So we have to help them. We have to help them have peace in their domain. Other than that, refugees begin to come because of violence. People begin to come and feed back on the little we have here, compete with us in our local market and what have you. So we are very much interested in peace in Nigeria. Probably this is the opportunity to call on all the political divides in Nigeria that, yes, the president is sick. But if you look at the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights and the Nigerian, their own laws and the provisions for human rights in their own constitution, it is a wrong premise for anybody to say that you are sick and therefore just put down your post. It is akin to asking a husband who has fallen ill that he is no longer a husband. I don't know how you take this comparison, but that is the similarity here.
Right. We want to thank you very much for your time on our show tonight. Very grateful.
I'm grateful for having me as well.
Ben Atta is peace and conflict expert. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana. We also have on the line Iribad Ibrahim. He is the CEO of Iribad Security Consult. Good evening and welcome to Behind the News.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Sir, what explains the demonstrations in Nigeria?
I think it's difficult to make head and tail of what some Nigerians are asking for. There is a video that has gone viral about a Nigerian actor who is with Nollywood calling for the president, Muhammadu Buhari, to either resume assume his duty as president or resign. And we need to understand the ethnic dynamics in Nigeria's politics. And for so long, apart from Nnamdi Azikiwe, who was instrumental in attaining independence for the country, he was from the East. He was from the Igbo area of the country. All the presidents we've had have either been Yoruba people or people of Northern extraction. So Olusegun Obasanjo, then IBB, Ibrahim Babangida from the North, and Sani Abacha, and a host of others. So therefore, we need to situate this grievance. And we know the Igbos at some point sparked off the Biafra War, mm-hmm. a secessionist struggle that was clamped down on by the government of the day. So therefore, constitutionally, Buhari did not force himself on the people of Nigeria. They had the option of choosing between him and a much more nimble and younger person, Goodluck Jonathan, and they gave him a resounding mandate. And the only way they can take him out of the scene is through the same ballot box through which they voted him into Aso Rock. Such calls are uncalled for, they are baseless, and they are inconsequential. The least you can do as compatriots is to pray for your president for a speedy recovery as he convalesces elsewhere. I have my own concerns about African leaders running to Western capitals to seek health care. Maybe if he were in a hospital in Abuja, Nigerians would understand. But the shuttle between Abuja and London is becoming one too many, and they think he's a president in absentia. So therefore, I believe they can start a due process that can constitutionally ease him out of power rather than calling for him to resign. They can call an early election. He can voluntarily resign. But apart from these two options, I don't see how demonstrations will force Buhari out of Aso Rock.
But will these demonstrations give the vice president that peace of mind to continue with governance?
The vice president has to be shrewd. He has to be savvy. If care is not taken, even though you would give Nigeria a clean bill of health in terms of its democratization process, there could be a palace coup that would take place. But we need to understand what the leadership of the APC, the All Progressives Congress, a coalition that came to torpedo the regime of the PDP under Goodluck Jonathan, we need to understand the sense of direction the leaders want to give the ruling party. But as things stand, I believe a good leader is the one who, even if in their absence, the wheels of governance continue to grind. So therefore, these calls for me are quite baseless, and Nigerians should exercise restraint. If sympathizers of Buhari are to pour onto the streets in equal measure, this would degenerate into a serious security challenge for the country. So therefore, they need to wait on him until the next election, or he voluntarily resigns.
But do you see any security implications from what has begun moving forward?
So far, Nigeria has been quite decorous. I think the people of Nigeria have exercised a lot of maturity. Nigeria, in fact, set the pace for the wind of change we've seen in the sub-region. On the back of the Nigerian election, we saw a good number of ruling parties lose elections. And the handing over has been quite peaceful, apart from the case of the Gambia, where the sub-region had to use the threat of force. So far, I believe, I don't want to believe that Nigerians would want to slit each other's throats because of this. And Muhammad Buhari started on a good note, plugging the leakages in the system by tackling corruption. Has he been a good leader? Certainly, that is up to Nigerians to judge. People make choices, and electorate across the world would regret or be happy based upon the choices they made at the polls. But I believe this should not be enough grounds for Nigerians to be at each other's throats. Civil society organizations in the country need to educate people. Sometimes you play on emotions. In matters of governance, you don't play on people's ethnic emotions. He has to continue to be his leader. He has to serve his mandate, complete his mandate for the while that he is constitutionally the leader of the country, until he decides to resign, or God Almighty decides what he did with Umar Yar'Adua. Then there would be a natural succession for the vice president, who is the heir apparent.
Well, so,
force him out of power because he has gone for treatment in another country. That is quite uncalled for and baseless.
Iriba, looking at the ethnic dynamics in Nigeria, and coming from what happened, the secessionist war from the east, the Biafra war I'm talking about, what should be the ideal response from the security agencies if they want to avoid this thing escalating to chaos?
I think the Igbos feel a bit marginalized. Many Ghanaians, many of the names we know in the movie industry are names of Igbo people. And because of that political, that seeming political marginalization, the elite in the East found solace in the moving industry to have an expression for themselves. That's why you can mention some of the most highly educated people, like Ramsey Noah and a host of others, or Sophia, and all of these are Igbo people. And so they found expression in the entertainment industry where they've been robbed of the opportunity to rule the country. Of course, this sparked off the war in Biafra. So therefore, they just need to position themselves strategically. It happens in most countries. In Ghana, there is an ethnic group that will come out and say it's an indigenous ethnic group, and it's waiting for a day a major political party will make their flag bearer one of their stock. It happens. Everybody has a sense of belonging when issues of ethnicity are discussed. But I believe the Igbos should chill out. They should let Buhari complete his mandate so that if they want to vote a 30-year-old or a 40-year-old into power, because they think young people don't fall sick. Young leaders even fall sick and they go abroad for treatment. So this argument is inconsequential. And I believe he should stay the course as president of the Federal Republic of Nigeria until the time is due for them to go to the polls again.
Can we accuse the opposition of having a hand in this?
In politics, a lot of things happen. When labor unions agitate, even in our own country, we point accusing fingers at the opposition party. So for every action a group of people take, there is a motivation. For Jim Iyke to overtly call for the resignation or resumption of duty on the part of Muhammadu Buhari, his inspiration might be coming from somewhere. And in politics, a lot of things happen. People in advocacy like us, and people that are seen as neutral people, people that are seen as people in the art industry, for example, this prolific writer, Wole Soyinka, you saw how his writings impacted the election that saw Muhammadu Buhari come to power. So therefore, people in the arts would have a reason for towing a certain line. So it won't be far-fetched to read, you know, partisan meaning into what is happening. But let's give Jim Iyke and others the benefit of the doubt. Being away for 92 days is long enough. I don't think Ghanaians would have the patience if our own president would be away for multiple months like that. It's good to have such a national debate within Nigeria's political space to understand how the president can delegate. He didn't force himself on the people of Nigeria. They democratically and freely elected him president, and they should have the patience. Everybody who is beyond 70 will have challenges with their health, and you knew this and voted him into power. So therefore, such, you know, agitation for me is inconsequential, and they just have to let it stay the course until his time is due to bid good riddance to the people calling for his head.
All right. Well, thank you very much. But a related development, the Independent Electoral Commission of Kenya has declared the results, and President Uhuru Kenyatta has won commanding lead, about 54%, opposition 44.67%. But there are demonstrations here and there from the opposition side. What should we be doing? Looking at what happened in 2007.
I returned from Kenya not long ago. I presented a paper at a university on Africa's security. In fact, when you get to Kenya, you understand that, yes, ethnicity plays a very key role in the governance system in Kenya. Uhuru Kenyatta belongs to the Kikuyu extraction, ethnic group. And there are other ethnic groups that feel marginalized. And therefore, Raila Odinga coming out to say he doesn't believe in the integrity of the process could portend serious security challenges. But normally, the posturing of the U.S. tells where the pendulum will swing. Apart from the Commonwealth Observer Mission, and the former Secretary of State of the U.S., John Kerry, is currently in Nairobi, and he's given the election a clean bill of health. So any agitation from Raila, knowing so well that the International Criminal Court has put some accusations of war crimes, crimes against humanity, atrocious crimes, and in the aftermath of the 2007 election, will force the hand of Raila Odinga and his party to exercise restraint. And again, the plate of the international community is full. And the world is concentrated on so many other security issues. North Korea is threatening to hit Guam, which is seen as the U.S. territory. And there is the war in Syria that has never abated. There are so many challenges. So even the international press is not given enough currency to the rejectionist posture of Raila Odinga.
Okay.
So I believe with time, some of these demonstrations will die down.
All
Nobody
right.
wants to see a rehash of what happened in the election in 2007.
Very grateful for your time on our show tonight. Iribad Ibrahim is the CEO of Iribad Security Consult. Some of your text messages... good evening, George. Our Muslim brothers and sisters have embarked on their annual pilgrimage to the Holy Land. May Allah see them through a safe journey to Mecca and back. Monica Kongs in Navrongo sent in that. You have delayed them enough, so now that they have boarded the plane, let them go. The vice president should not waste their time because they are already late. What's farewell? It's been known. Now, from Baba Abu Inwa, Philip Cobreso in Ofenso South says, Cobreso, how's it Cobreso? Okay. The main motive behind NDC school is to teach their members propaganda in politics. It's about time Ghanaians were circumspect of politicians.
On the fire of water,